The Legal Lowdown on Kerry Today.
Yes, indeed. Mary McGillicuddy, good morning to you and thanks for joining us in the programme again.
Good morning, Gerry, and good morning, listeners, on this fine morning. And no rain, anyway, at the moment.
And no rain so far, thankfully. Miriam, we're going to start with a query and a good few that came into us the last time you were on with us. A listener got in touch, Tom in the Stoles, says, I borrowed money in 1994 from the ACC Bank. There was a charge put on the deeds of the farm. This loan was fully repaid over 20 years ago. However, the charge is still on the deeds. And the problem is ACC Bank is now gone. How do I get the charge taken off the deeds is Tom's question.
Yeah, and he isn't the only one here. I mean, a lot of people would have had loans from ACC and they've been repaid a considerable number of years ago, usually, because ACC has gone a considerable period of time. And it's Rabobank have actually taken over the legacy issues there of ACC. And the email is acclegacy@rabobank.com.
And okay, so Rabobank Ireland came in. It was three different banking entities that were part of the Rabobank, which is a Dutch group. It was ACC Loan Management, Rabobank Ireland, and Rabobank Direct, Rabodirect Ireland. But they then themselves stopped in around 2018, doesn't operate banking here, but they're still a financial company.
Yeah.
And they have that email. So that's where Tom and anyone needs to start.
Exactly. Now, sometimes they don't do the new e-discharges, which mean that you don't have to send anything into them. They just take the charge off the folio. They do need a deed of discharge to be done. So he may need to go to his solicitor to draft up the deed of discharge based on his deeds and send it into them. But if he just contacts them, they'll let him know what's needed and he can follow up to get the deed off the folio. He'd need the folio number as well and maybe a copy of his folio showing that the ACC charge is still on them and they let him know what their requirements are. But all is not lost. People don't need to worry if this is the case and it can be got. There's always somebody who takes over the mantle to take the likes of charges off folios. I mean, we'd Green Shield stamps and other people from way back on folios, and there's always somebody that you can apply to get the charge off.
Okay, very good. Miriam, good morning, Gerry. Can you please ask Miriam, can you contest the valuation the council has put on your house? As they went about buying my house this year, the valuation was crazy compared to a house a few doors down. Exact same kind of house in the same area.
Yeah, I mean, you could. It's supposed to be open market valuation. And if you feel that it's not, it's too high an open market valuation, you have the right to go and get your own separate valuation and argue with the council on the valuation. Having said all that, you should be giving you a discount off the purchase price of the house of between 40 and 60%. I presume the listener's issue is that he's getting the 40 to 60% off a very large figure. And if he feels it's unfair, he can approach the council about it. We've had situations in the past as well where maybe somebody's put in a lot of improvements and made a lot of alterations to the house, and one could argue that should be taken into account as well. So I suppose it's a matter of advocating for oneself and getting the independent value, another valuation, and saying that your valuation is not realistic and this is a truer valuation based on, because as we know, valuers, when they go to value houses, look at what houses have sold for in an area, and they're very often attached to the back of their valuations comparatives. So he could get another independent valuation if he feels it's far too high and work from there.
Yeah, okay, so that's a way to go around it from that point of view. Another query coming in, Miriam. Can an executor contact other family members advising them to go against a father's will because the executor did not want the main beneficiary, a brother, to get what was left to him in the will?
Yeah, I can understand the brother's concern, especially if he's the main beneficiary, because the executor is kind of a trustee operating in relation to the will. But he may feel also that other family members have been hard done by, and I suppose he's only letting them know what their legal rights are in relation to the situation. At the end of the day, it's up to those other family members whether they want to take action or not. And I suppose he's just alerting them to the legal position in this situation.
Yeah, so it's not kind of organised. They're entitled to contact or to make that contact.
Yeah, and they're entitled to, you know, discuss it with them and explain, I suppose, what the legal scenario is in relation to the will, you know, in relation to other family members who may have been left out.
Okay, another query in here, Miriam. This is in the area of family law. A listener wants to know, can you ask Miriam, why is a child's voice during a Section 32 heard? Why do judges dismiss their voices? Or why isn't, sorry, a child's voice heard during a Section 32? What's the point in these interviews? In my opinion, children are forced into a situation they don't like. It's about time the in-camera rule is dismantled.
Yeah, I mean, obviously somebody probably that was unhappy with the Section 32 report, but these Section 32 reports are reports authorised by the 2015 Child and Family Relationships Act, and it allows experts to be appointed by the court who will operate, they have to operate according to the best interests of the child. So they, depending on the mature age and maturity of the child, they listen to the child's views and they relay to the court what is in the best interests of the child. So it's totally a child-focused report, usually by a child expert. So it's very well, pretty well curtailed in the legislation as to what type of a report it is. And then there's been statutory regulations setting out the type of people who can do the reports. And they'd usually be child psychologists, social care workers with a lot of child experience, and other child experts, as I say, who are very experienced in the area. If one is unhappy with the report, one can bring the expert to court and they can be cross-examined because, I mean, everybody's human at the end of the day and they may have picked up the wrong end of the stick and may have received a wrong impression. And that can be challenged through the court process, in the forensic court process where there's examination and cross-examination. And if necessary, then the court may order that the report, they won't go with the report, and they may order other reports to be done, and they do listen to all the parties, because at the end of the day, it's the child's best interests are being considered here.
It's the main thing in all those cases.
The other issue I think that the listener here has a problem with is the in-camera rule, that everything is going on behind closed doors. And we had two relaxations to the in-camera rule to allow in experts to kind of take a note of what's happening in family law. And we have childcare cases are being reported on an ongoing basis. And also journalists can go in to family law cases and report on how things are done in family law court. So we do have certain reporting.
Yeah, there is an insight there, obviously with names redacted and all of that, but there is an insight there into what is going on.
It's important that the identity of the family and the parties are hidden, but we do have a lot of reporting of child cases, especially from the cities where obviously it's easier to disguise identity and all that kind of thing. But just to note that the in-camera rule has been relaxed to that extent, and we do have reporting on these child cases.
Yeah. Okay, Miriam, stay with me. We've more to get to. Any queries or questions, get them into us now for Miriam on The Legal Lowdown. More after we take these.
The Legal Lowdown on Kerry Today.
Yeah, Miriam McGillicuddy will be on the line for The Legal Lowdown. Miriam, we have more queries coming into us here. A listener gets in touch and says, a non-resident of the state, a student in another country, inherits a house from a non-relative. Is there any way of minimising the capital gains tax in that situation? I would imagine probably no, but is there any avenue?
Well, you see, I think the the student there is talking about maybe capital acquisitions tax more than capital gains tax, because
if the inheritance tax
is the capital acquisitions tax, and basically anything over 20,000 would be, because they're not a relative, would be taxed at 33%. Now, if there had been planning before that, they might have been able to do the house exemption, you know, where the student might have been living with the relative, albeit a student in another country, but having their base with that relative for 3 years before the inheritance. Or the other one, curiously enough, is where even people who are strangers in blood, but might be close friends, there have been situations where people have got married in the past simply to avoid the capital acquisitions tax. But we've seen those kind of situations. But the other point then is, I think, where he's talking about capital gains tax, where maybe he inherits the house and the house is valued for the purpose of that inheritance, and it might be valued at maybe 200,000. If the, and then he pays his tax on that, his or her tax on that. If they sell the house then for 300,000, there could be a capital gains tax implication there. So just to be alert to that, that there could be two taxes here, capital acquisitions tax and capital gains tax.
And capital gains.
Yeah.
So just to be okay, if a property was transferred to children before parents pass away, would they still pay inheritance tax?
Yes, if they're over their threshold of 400,000, gift and inheritance tax are exactly the same. The thresholds are the same. So if it's given as a gift, it would be, you know, they have up to 400,000 that they can inherit tax-free. However, if it's transferred during the lifetime, there's two other taxes involved, capital gains tax and stamp duty. So often people leave it to, that it would go by will, whereby there wouldn't be those other two taxes necessarily, the capital gains tax and the stamp duty.
And Lisa gets in touch with a property management problem, Miriam, this morning. Can Miriam advise, please? A once beautiful private property development gated at both ends. Now it's run down and shabby. The gates are out of order for months, so a thoroughfare for antisocial behaviour. According to the management company, a lot of residents haven't paid the annual management fee for a number of years, and the money isn't there for cleaning, painting and grass cutting, etc. Most importantly, to fix the electric gates. The money is going on legal fees. Now, obviously, we don't know why money is going on legal fees, but is there any resolution to it, Miriam, in terms of that? Or maybe an AGM or an EGM to be called, or
something of that nature. I mean, it's unfortunate for the person, and they're obviously living in the property, and they common areas would be run by a management company of which they are a member. So obviously, to get more involved with the management company and see what's going on there in reality, and also maybe get involved as a director and be involved in the decisions around where the money is going, would be very helpful. And also, I suppose, looking at the management fee, is it enough? And do they need to up the management fee to cover all the things they want to do? Because it's in everybody's best interest at the end of the day, because it'll increase the value of the houses if they keep it the beautiful private property that it was. So I suppose getting maybe more involved in the management company would be an answer there.
Going door to door, perhaps, maybe encouraging people to attend,
exactly,
trying to get the argument that it's in everyone's interest that this is all paid and that everyone pays, otherwise the value of the entire estate will fall.
Yeah, that's right. And you're dead right, Gerry, to kind of get a community feel going in the area and a pride in the estate, and that everyone would get on board in relation to the decision making, attending the problem is sometimes people don't attend the annual general meetings and don't keep the interest going in their own estate, and that can reflect itself in the estate then. So I think getting involved would do a lot there, and not letting the people, the management, the present management off the hook, and just say we need this to improve, and looking at what needs to be done then.
Okay, Miriam, a query in here from a listener about their car. I have a query about my car. I purchased it last March. At the time of purchase, we purchased an extra warranty for protection. After a month, the car lost power and a warning came on the dash. I brought it back to the dealership. They gave me a courtesy car. They were to bring it to a gearbox specialist, but they didn't, and then said the fault had cleared. I received my car back within a week. In May, the car lost power again, and this time I was told to contact the warranty company directly and deal with them and not the car dealership. I was without my car for a month. Thankfully, it was fixed by an external garage company, but with a cost to me. I sent an email to the dealership. I personally gave them a letter of complaint. However, I heard nothing back. Furthermore, I tried to contact the Society of the Irish Motor Industry with no success so far. It's disappointing. I feel consumers have such little rights when you're dealing with dealerships to treat you like that. And when I did mention taking legal action, they replied, "Work away. We have someone else to deal with that side of things." I feel it's disgraceful customers can be treated like this. What advice on this? Where could I go with it?
Yeah, I mean, very difficult. And I have to say that the second-hand car area is one of the areas where you get an awful lot of...
lots of issues arise.
Yeah, customer complaints. Yeah. You see, with the second-hand car, they usually only give the warranty, the personal warranty for the garage is usually only about 6 months, and it would have expired in this case. And then presumably they got an extra warranty and the garage are then fobbing it off on the warranty company. And hopefully she might try be able to get her money back through the warranty company, because that's presumably part of her insurance in relation to the scenario. Otherwise, she could take a small claims court case if the amount wasn't too much that it cost her. But otherwise, if she's to take a case through the normal court system, through the district or the circuit court, it's very expensive. And it's so expensive that people with...
It's prohibitive to the value of what you're trying to get the remedy for.
Exactly. That's right, yeah. So there would be... This scenario is a very good case for raising the limit of the small claims court and, you know, specifically to deal with car issues. Because the case law over the years as well in relation to second-hand cars doesn't always guarantee you get your money back, because it's not like a new car. A new car, you're entitled to, you know, trouble-free driving for a good portion of time. But with the second-hand car, often they look, the court's looking at it, oh, look, if you get it to drive it for a year or two, sure, isn't that good? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas at least you got to drive it for a while. But so it's not necessarily very helpful to the person buying the second-hand car and trying to say it's not of merchantable quality and all that. Having said another thing I just want to highlight for listeners, if they're thinking of buying a second-hand car, that's very on the consumer agency website, there's a whole list of things to look out for and things that can help you in relation to trying to prevent problems down the line, you know, in almost a query sheet in relation to the car, and also checkups to make sure it's not stolen and all that kind of thing, or crashed before. So just to follow that as well, if anyone's thinking of buying a second-hand car, just to try and preempt problems. Yeah.
Okay. Miriam, caller bought a car a while back and we have been having ongoing issues where the car won't start. The car is not being repaired. The company isn't very willing to help us out. Our guarantee runs out in January 2026. We were wondering what happens if the issue has not been resolved. Where do we stand legally? But similar to the last issue, really.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, they need to kind of sit on the garage to get it sorted out. And also keep a record, you know, emails that they've reported in the issue and that they want it dealt with, and to make sure it's dealt with within the guarantee. Because often garages might fob people off, they might do a little repair and then the car is out of guarantee or out of warranty and they've no comeback at all other than the courts. So important that it's sorted out within the guarantee period. And keep, as I say, keep a record. Phone calls aren't enough. It needs to be an email. It needs to be in writing that you've reported it.
Yeah, yeah. Have records of that. Okay, Miriam, listen, we're going to leave it there, but thanks a million for answering all those queries. We've lots of queries to get to that came into us this morning as well, but thanks for talking to us for the Legal Lowdown this morning.
Thank you, Gerry, and thank you, listeners, and have a lovely week.